time. But yeah, at least.
Excuse for the day.
Good morning, everyone. How are we all doing today? The proper response in Arabic would be Alhamdulillah. Thanks be to God, right? Regardless of whether you're doing fine or not so fine, it's always, you know, that guy's fault anyway, so you may as well say Alhamdulillah, thanks be to God. So, number of things. First of all, some technical stuff that I want to talk about. A little bit more Moodle and pictures. I didn't get pictures on Thursday on here, or they just got eaten up by, I don't know, the dog or cyberspace or something like that. So I'm going to send this around one more time. I think most of you were happy with pictures. I think there's two folks in the class whose pictures I don't have yet. So add your name on the bottom and take a picture, and then hopefully I will be able to retrieve them from the card and put it on. So same exercise as we did on Thursday one more time. Check mark right next to your picture if everything is all right, etc., etc. I'd ask you to introduce yourselves on Moodle. I think most of you have done so. If you haven't done so yet, please do. So just that we all know that you can post on Moodle, right? So introduce yourself just in one line or five lines or 10, whatever you want. And then, as far as paper topics are concerned, I'd encourage you to start thinking about it. I've gotten a couple of emails from you all wanting to meet with suggestions. What we're going to do in a few minutes is we're going to look at a couple of resources that you can consult as kind of a first stab at a particular topic, and then, you know, we can get conversation going. Again, my invitation to you all, send me an email. If you want to meet with me, in that email, give me a couple of selected slots, time slots that work for you. My preferences, overall speaking, in general, I teach Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, so Mondays and Fridays are days where I'm really flexible. I can meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays, if need be, in the afternoon. So send me a few suggested meeting times. That makes it easier, so we don't have to email 10 times before we actually settle on something. Moodle, what I just posted this morning is a couple of research links, quick links, and we're going to find out in a second whether they actually work, to what I would consider some of the better quick access points to reliable information. In Islamic study, the mother of all books, that's, you know, what the Quran is ordinarily, but the mother of all books in study is the Encyclopedia of Islam. Important, so that you find it if you are looking for the book source. This is spelled the European way. Encyclopedia, A-E in here, right? So if you're in the library, you're looking for the book, you can't find it under the English spelling, change your spelling and then you can find it. It's a 13-volume. By now, actually, we're in the third edition. In the third edition, I'm not sure how many volumes that's going to be ending up with, but that is the one reliable source for everything Islamic that people go to first. It's out of Leiden, Brill Publishers. Super, super expensive. But we have it in the library, and of course, 21st century, we actually don't have to set foot in the library, and now let's see whether it actually works. Yes, it does. Alhamdulillah. Thanks be to God. So this is now the electronic version that has a combination of 1, 2, 3, edition 1, 2, 3. So the latest edition, whatever they are done with, is already accessible. So any type of topic that you want to research, you would key in here. Let's do a quick experiment. Anybody have any topic that they're interested in that we should run through here?
Temporary marriage,
right? So, temporary marriage. And I think I spelled it correctly. And this does now not just look through Encyclopedia Islam, but through others as well. Lo and behold, here we have a couple of hints. Actually, the first one by the central researcher in the field, who is Shahla Hariri. And then we also have it mentioned under other topics, such as marriage, and divorce. And what you see here is the word count for each of the entries. And so you can scroll through, so you have a good number of hits. So the first one is actually not from the Encyclopedia of Islam, but the Brill search also gets you to the Encyclopedia of the Quran and to other resources, so the Brill Dictionary of Religion and eWIC, which is the second most important source, particularly for this field. We're going to get there in a second. So lots of hits there, right? And as we all know by now, this is not the first paper that we're writing. When you have a topic, you start out with kind of the bird's eye perspective, right? That is to say, the encyclopedic and dictionary articles will give you the overview, say, from space, from 2,000 miles up. You get the entire topic into view. And then, of course, your job is from there to focus in on a particular aspect that is of particular interest to you. But this is a first step at the field at large. And then you can kind of, you know, look at what is interesting to you and hone in on the subject matter. Right? Everybody see how this works? So, Encyclopedia of Islam is the most important one, I would say. Now, I should also say that the Encyclopedia of Islam is edited primarily by quote-unquote what we call Orientalists. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. And Orientalists, not necessarily in the negative sense of the word, but the folks that do the old-fashioned stuff, history and philology and those things. So topics of antiquity are more prominently exhibited in the Encyclopedia of Islam. If you're more interested in contemporary issues, eWIC is helping you. That's the second link that I have here before we get to topic one. This is also done by Brill. So when you go to the Encyclopedia of Women and Islamic Cultures, that's a fairly recent project. They started, what, in the 2000s or something like that, but they still added, by now, I think, 5 volumes or something like that. But it's more specifically geared to what we're interested in, and that is women in Islamic cultures. And so again, you could do similar searches here. My suspicion would be it's also Brill outfit, and since the databases overlap, that on temporary marriage, you probably would find similar entries. Right? So that's number two, I would say. And then number three is to get away from from Brill and the European side of scholarship. The Oxford Islamic Studies Online is also a resource that can be very valuable. So let's see whether that link actually works. Here we go. And that is actually a combination of various resources done by Oxford UP. So all three, I would say, are fine initial tools to get you somewhat into a subject that you're interested in. So whatever subject you're interested in, if you have not already done so, just go play around with your subject, put it in any of those and see what you find, and then again, you will read, and then hopefully one topic will grab your attention and you will fall in love with it, and it will make for a pleasant experience for you while you do the research, and it's going to be making for a very pleasant experience for me when I read your paper. Right? So everybody on board. So my encouragement to you all, do this. It started with my caution to you, again, all of you have done this already at Furman. You will be doing a fair amount of reading. My own experience when it comes to doing research is that about 90, sometimes 95% of the reading that I'm doing doesn't end up in the paper. Doesn't mean it's wasted. I learned a whole lot in those 95% of readings. But it's not ending up in the paper, it's just kind of background knowledge that kind of helps me to focus in on what I'm really interested in, right? So, you know, there's going to be plenty of reading, but reading has never hurt anybody. reading is actually a good thing to do in general, not just to write papers, but that's it. Okay, any questions on any of that? We all good on that? What I would encourage you to do is, when you start thinking about topics, draw on the expertise of others in the class, and just bend, start around, throw ideas out there, apart from the ones listed on the syllabus. And so for that, if you have some idea that you're thinking about, share it with the class and see what other people think on that. And so what I would hope would develop over the next week or so is interesting conversations, temporary marriage. Somebody else has heard about other aspects of temporary marriage or knows somebody who has heard about, has traveled in Iran, what have you. And then we can kind of share experiences, ideas, what have you, and hopefully some conversation on that one. Since we have Moodle up, I don't think I've done this. Let me just quickly say a few words on Moodle. Of course, primary function of Moodle is that it gives you access to various reading materials, and not just reading, but also other visual materials, whatever. I want to distribute this is a very easy way to do that. Moodle hopefully also will be a somewhat of a communication tool throughout the term, but particularly then also in preparation for exams. I think we have briefly talked about various glossaries that are up there where you all will work on your own study guides. So when it comes to the midterm example and already for the first exam, there's going to be a glossary where you toss in what you learned, and it's kind of flashcard system for the entire class. Everybody in class throws in 5 to 7 of those, and lo and behold, all of a sudden you have a very fine pool of flashcards accessible for everybody. The same with essay questions suggested for the exams. I'm going to ask you all to think about questions that you would like to see an answer on the midterm or the final exam. And so that is also going to be study guide. So those are some of the functions. Moodle, nice, very useful, but Moodle also has a dark side. And I just right off the bat, from the beginning, let you know that if you think that NSA is scary, you haven't seen nothing yet. Moodle is very scary as well. Moodle is keeping somewhere in the background access information of every single student who has ever logged on, when you log on, from what IP address you're logging on, and what materials you're accessing. Right? So at the end of the term, there is thousands and thousands of records that student A has logged on at 5 a.m. on Monday morning to read this particular piece or post that particular one. All of the information is on there. Now, I'm just too busy to look at it. I'm just saying it's out there. What I'm going to do at the end of the day is Moodle is part of the page, right? So I'm going to generate generic reports. Student A has logged on throughout the term 300 times. And student B has logged on 600 times. Student A has actively participated, i.e. posted and responded to others' comments 3 times, and student B has actively participated 33 times. Right? That will give me somewhat of a sense that student A probably doesn't deserve quite as high participation grade for Moodle as student B does. You all following? So just be aware every single time you log on, don't want to scare you too much here, but I'm just saying all of that material, all of that information is being stored by Moodle. And at the end of the day, I'm going to generate a very basic report looking at how often you've logged on, when, what if I should get the feeling somewhere in there. We have an assigned reading through Moodle, and I get the feeling that not many students have read it. I can go to Moodle and I can check which students actually have opened the document and which students have not. Right? So just be aware of that. All right? Everybody in a good place? So, those are some of the technical things that
we need to talk about. Then we have two major topics for today. One of them is Luckenbohl's piece on great versus little tradition, traditions, and the other one is Ella Schuhart's piece on Hollywood's Orient. In, I want to go to Luckenbohl first to think a little bit about the question of the study of Islam and the question of the definition of Islam. Luckenbohl is drawing on a number of different theorists, anthropologists in particular, on the question, what is Islam? Can we define Islam? It is coming up more or less with two basic positions of Islam as either a great tradition, just borrowing this from earlier sociologist, or a little tradition. And then it's bantering about various arguments as to how to get access to and then how to define Islam. And the definitional question is one that is going to be sticking with us for a long time. At the end of the course, we're still going to be wondering what the hell was it that we were studying here. And that is not just true for Islam. Many of you are aware that that's true also for other religious traditions. And so based on sociologist Redfield, the characteristics of great and little traditions, I think in the first couple of pages, depending on how your print works, there's a couple of adjectives and characteristics of each of these religious of these models that the author talks about, Luckenbohl talks about. What are some of the characteristics or adjectives of each of these? Yes, and names again.
Lauren. One of the basic, I guess, distinctions between great and little is that the great tradition is more of, I guess, they say the urban elite.
Okay. It's the urban elite that is standing behind, that is preaching, that is practicing whatever this tradition, or it's characterized as urban and elite, versus?
Versus, I guess, the more, I guess they say folk or the daily life of regular people.
So we have folk, daily life, folks. Okay, so that's one. So dichotomous construction here, and there are other characteristics. And your name?
Alice.
Alice.
He also talks about the great tradition as being more orthodox.
Okay.
And little tradition as being heterodox.
Okay. So orthodox versus heterodox. Now very quickly on vocab. Orthodox means what? And heterodox means what? Little majors know this. Others may want to have that explained in a word or two.
Is orthodox like original, the tradition of the first one?
Okay, original is one way of characterizing it.
Alexis. Another was if you, they're the ones who like practice it exactly by the book.
Okay, so by the book, literally from Greek, orthodoxein, to speak straight, right? Straight talk. So that's kind of the party line, right? That's kind of the established, and of course, it's in the eye of the beholder, right? Somebody's orthodoxy is another person's heresy, right? But the idea is that, you know, it's kind of the hegemonic system that wins the day, right? Versus heterodox, the doxa is in both of them speaking, but speaking alternatively, you may say, that is to say non-orthodox, alternative positions, right? And also, of course, in singularity, and this one comes in multi voiced fashion. Okay, so again, difference.
The great tradition is like a universal representation, while the little tradition is more localized and, I guess just localized.
Okay, so universality versus localization, you may say. Okay, what else we got?
For great traditions to spread, it has to appeal to like a mass.
Okay, mass appeal. Well, versus. So it's kind of appeal, kind of along these lines, right? So localized, not everybody. So you know, somewhere over there. Those are some of the big ones. So this, in theory, now let's flesh this out in practice. On Islam, of course, we are kind of at an intro stage. Some of us have had some exposure to Islam. Some of us have had little exposure to Islam. Most of us, however, have had exposure to Christianity or tees, right? So for a second, how would this flesh itself out in Christianity or Christianities? What would be data samples that would be reflective of great tradition, and what would be data samples or examples that would be reflective of a little tradition? Is little and great tradition in that dichotomy also something that we find in other religious traditions? The author says yes, right? If so, in Christianity, the author says yes. What would be some examples? And the name.
Elena.
Elena.
Wouldn't it be, I guess, like, the great tradition would be like something like the Catholic Church, whereas like they take it really seriously and everything else like that. But then a little tradition would be like, I don't know.
Right. Well, they take it seriously. The it in there is what we're talking about here, right? What is the it that
the text
is?
Say what? Bible.
Okay, so the Bible as a text, right? So that would be probably on the great tradition side, not necessarily to mean that Bible ain't existing here. What maybe others? What maybe, for example, orthodoxies? And your name?
SK. Like the hierarchy of the church people, the ruling body of the church.
Okay, so there's certain types of hierarchy in there. So such as the papacy, for example, right? Papacy and then papacy, etc. Other examples of great or of little tradition? Local types of tradition that are folk, that are heterodox, that are localized. What about the doctrine of the Trinity? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or Holy Ghost. Great tradition, little tradition. Comes out of the biblical thing, is an orthodox position. That would be over here, right? What about Easter? Eggs and bunnies. Easter, eggs, and bunnies? Great tradition, little tradition? Or both? Or what's going on? Make argument. Easter, bunnies in the 10th century of the Common Era. Or 11th. Actually, I don't know when Easter bunny arose. Easter bunny long time ago. Christmas tree. Christmas tree 1,000 years ago. Great tradition or little tradition? Little tradition is what I hear. Okay. Why little tradition?
It doesn't come straight from the Bible, but it's
adapted
by God.
Okay. So it doesn't come from the Bible, it doesn't come from the urban elite, it actually comes from we guys, right? The Germans. We were tree worshippers. That's one very oversimplified and not really entirely correct way of putting it, but Germans are into trees. And in order to get them Germans into the Christian boat, we just adopted three, right? Together with the date, right? 24, 25 of December. Is that Jesus' birthday? Was that in his passport? Probably not, right? So all of those traditions are folk traditions of a particular tribe. Over time, they become very popular. And nobody can resist Germans, right? So by now, everybody the world over has adopted Christmas tree as a tradition. So it becomes somewhat tricky. At what point in time is little tradition turning into a great tradition or vice versa? You're following the argument? So on the one hand side, yes, those exist. On the other hand side, there's also these kinds of overlaps. Right? So we have that with the Christmas tree. We have it with the date of Christmas. We have it with the Easter bunny. Excuse me, we have it with the Easter eggs. And you probably can think of other examples. Then you can think of local Christian traditions in the context of South Carolina or the Deep South, snake handling, what have you, all kinds of interesting local expressions of religious tradition that are not shared by the Pope or others, right? So we have this thing, and then the question that you can ask of Christianity, and then of course by extension also other religious traditions, so is it Christian? Is the Christmas tree Christianity or not? Is celebrating Easter and Easter Bunny Christian or not? What would you say? And your name?
Kelsey. And I would argue that neither of them are essential to the core practice of the religion,
okay.
But I don't think that you can separate culture that's evolved over the years from the way that common people practice.
Okay.
At least in America.
So it's problematic to separate culture from religion to a certain extent, and then that culture also incorporates theological concepts over time. So it's not the case that we worship the Easter Bunny because of fertility issues, right? But we reinterpret symbolism in Christian tradition to turn that into notions of hope, renewal of life, rebirth, those kinds of things. So now theological concepts that are central to Christian tradition are being injected into symbols that previously were non-Christian. So in that case, it becomes somewhat... So you can't really say, the expression of rebirth in an Easter egg is un-Christian because rebirth is a central Christian method, right? So the two of them become homologated, come together. So it becomes tricky. Okay, this is not on Christianity. Of course, we're talking about Islam. The reason that I'm mentioning this is that the same questions obtain in Islam. That is to say, there are those that will make argument or will want to make argument, this is not Islam. Right? This is other than Islam. For example, anybody heard of FGM or FGC? Female genital cutting or female genital mutilation. Anybody heard of that? Okay. So, is it Islamic? Is it not Islamic? It's not in the Quran. There are a few hadiths that may be read to support the practice. There's lots and lots and lots of Muslims that are opposed to the practice. And there are also non-Muslims that practice FGM or FGC. So is it Islamic? Is it not Islamic? Tricky question, right? Depends on who you ask. Okay. Osama bin Laden, is that Islamic? Right? Depends on who you ask. There's lots and lots and lots of people that would say no. There are some people that would say yes. Obversely, and that's not quite great in little tradition, but it's a question to keep in mind, Adolf Hitler, Christian or not Christian? You looked at his passport. Back in the day, you actually had your religious tradition stamped into the passport up until fairly recently in Germany. If you're Lutheran, you have an L in there. If you're Roman Catholic, you have an RK in there. Look at Hitler's passport, at least the early version. Clearly, religion stamped in there. So from that perspective, Adolf Hitler, a Christian. Right? So, the reason I'm raising those questions right off the bat is it's complicated. There are no simple answers. The enterprise that we're going to be engaging in is a very messy enterprise. What we can say right off the bat is that any statement that starts with Islam is or Islam isn't is an incorrect statement. Just as any statement that says Christianity is or Christianity isn't is an incorrect statement. Okay. It's messy. We're going to have a whole lot of messy questions on our hands And the beauty of all of it is that it keeps people like myself in business. Because if we all had all the answers, I would be jobless. We get to think and rethink constantly because it's a messy business. Okay? All right, so much on that. Now we'll move on a little bit on the question of gender and Hollywood, and I want to take it a little bit further on the question of preconceptions. We come to the study of these religious traditions and to the study of gender from a particular historical, social, geographical locatedness. We're going to argue for the next 45 minutes in form of a PowerPoint, the parts of which some of you have seen beforehand, but I've shifted it with a gender focus, to talk a little bit about our own locatedness in the discourse. And that is to say, when you study a religious tradition, nobody comes at it as a blank slate. We all already, right from the start, have already our own commitments. We already have our own conceptions, and those commitments and conceptions are shaped by our own histories. Now, for the sake of simplicity, I will make oversimplified assumptions about y'all. And those oversimplified assumptions will be incorrect. I know that. But I think that there is, at least to a certain extent, among many of us, a shared cultural, historical background. We grew up, many of us, I should say, grew up in, quote unquote, oversimplified, the Western context, and have had our own exposure to questions of religion. And so what I'm going to do now is, since we're already in oversimplification, I'm going to run through about 2,000 years of misperception of the religious other. And I'm going to do that in 45 minutes. And just study the basic question, in what ways do those misperceptions that I claim have been out there for a long time still stay with us today? In what ways are those misperceptions being reproduced for us and reproduced through us? Okay. So that's kind of the big thing on the big item on the menu. So very quickly, if you look at or think about the question of a comparative study of religion in broad terms, you may make argument that it's an undertaking as old as history itself. Herodotus, quote-unquote, the father of history, in one of his travels to Egypt, comes back and makes a very offhandish observation. He says, well, the Egyptians are not really that different from us Greeks. Just as we do, they worship different gods, they just call them by different names. Big one. No big problem for Herodotus in a polytheistic environment, worshipping multiple gods, to think about the religious other, about other people, who also worship multiple gods. If you already worship 3, 4, 5, 10, what's another 10, 4, 20, right? The problem of the religious other becomes a problem primarily for the monotheist. If you're a monotheist, you believe in one god, then any type of claim of existence of another god must strike you minimally as odd, or more likely as wrong-headed, incorrect, or probably as outrightly evil, because somebody is claiming something that goes against your deeply held beliefs of truth. Right? So monotheism, in that sense, is somewhat of a problematic proposition. We see that for the first time with the Hebrew prophets. Those of you who have studied Israelite history know that monotheism is itself a development of Israelite religious tradition. And the Hebrew prophets don't have very nice things to say about competing religious traditions, the gods of Canaan, Baal, and so forth. Right? Very nasty language that is used on religious competitors. They become dehumanized in biblical scripture. That attitude of the religious other, religious competitor, as a problem is something that Christianity inherits. So now fast forward into early Christian times. Christianity deriving out of Hebrew tradition, out of Judaism, you may say. Initially, a minority religious tradition by the 4th century becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire, and then becomes the official religious tradition of the empire, and then has to compete against initially two other competitors, the still quote-unquote pagan antique Greco-Roman religious traditions in the Mediterranean basin, and then Judaism, right? And the competition with Judaism will take on a form of dichotomy that is still with us today. So say Christians will argue, we are the new kids on the block, we are the new ones. You guys are the old ones, new is better than old. Right? To this day, Christian traditions refer to the two major books of the Bible as the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Old Testament is the inheritance from Judaism, or simplified speaking. The New Testament is the stuff that Christians themselves add. And there's valuation in that language. It's still a reflection of this old-new dichotomy. Because it implies new is somehow better, superior to old. Right? There's value in that language. What would happen if we were to rename those scriptures? And instead of calling them Old Testament and New Testament, we would call them First Testament and Second Testament. How would that change our perception of those scriptures?
Well, you think of, like, number one, so you would automatically go to that one first, and then second, you're just like, oh, that's
good. It came in second. Yeah. You know, that's not the genuine side. The genuine side is the number one. I want you to see how that changes perception. Right? So that's kind of the competitive field that Christianity finds itself in, with that basic claim, new is better than old. That all works well, at least for Christians, up until the 7th century, and then you have a yet newer kid on the block. And that newer kid on the block is Islam, right? Rising out of the Arabian Peninsula. And so Christian apologetic discourse now has to develop new toolage to compete with this newest religious tradition. Old new doesn't work any longer. So the model that is going to be adopted is a model to decry Islam as a heresy, as a religious tradition gone away. And the way that medieval discourse will construct the argument is it will falsely claim a parallel, a dichotomy between Jesus and Muhammad. So first step is to compare those two, to make argument they are equivalent in their roles for the respective religious traditions. And then secondly, to claim this is a good guy, this is a bad guy, hence Christianity is a true religion, Islam is a false religion. Right? What I'm going to suggest is that this basic comparison between Jesus and Muhammad is already mistaken. It is a comparison between apples and oranges. And what I'm going to also claim is that good guy, bad guy, as we all know, it's never as simple as that. It's much more complicated. Let's start with proposition one. Jesus is to Christianity what Muhammad is to Islam. You can see already in the way that Jesus functions for Christianity that this proposition is quite correct, whereas this one is not. It is, after all, the case that the name of the tradition, Christianity, named after Jesus the Christ, right? So Christ is central to Christianity. The major festivals of the Christian calendar, Christmas and Good Friday and Easter, are centrally focused on the life and death of Jesus the Christ, right? So yes. And three, the counting of the years we are in, supposedly, the year 2015 A.D. A.D., anybody by any chance know what A.D. stands for? No, Latinists. Anno Domini, the year of the Lord, right? So it's actually the 2015th year after the birth of the Lord. Incidentally, footnote on the side, apart from the lecture, in comparative study of religion, we ought to adopt value-neutral language. While it is true that for Christians, Jesus is indeed the Lord, is a Dominus, that is not true for non-Christians. However, we cannot, well, we are too lazy to actually adopt a new calendar system. We could actually, for the term, go with the Muslim calendar system. At the end of the day, everybody's head would hurt. So what we're going to do is we're going to keep the years. So we agree we are in year 2015, but we're going to refer to it as CE of the Common Era, acknowledging, yes, it's a calendar that has been established worldwide, but not everybody agrees that Jesus is Lord. You are following that footnote. Okay. So my encouragement to you, we use the system, the numbers, but we shy away from ideologically laden language in comparative study of religion. Follow? Close the footnote, back to the main story. So, name of the religious tradition, major festivals, and counting of the years, yes, all of them focused on Jesus the Christ. Let's do the test with Muhammad. Is the religious tradition named after him? No. There are some that propose, and actually we have titles up until the 50s of last century, where people refer to Islam as Mohammedanism, but that's a Western invention. So, the festivals, major festivals of the Muslim calendar, are not focused on life or death of Muhammad. The major ones are focused on Abraham, fasting, and the end of the month of Ramadan, and the sacrifice, the almost sacrifice of Abraham. Calendar itself also not focused on the birth or death of Muhammad, but it's focused, we're going to learn this later, on the exodus of the persecuted Muslim community. So on all three, no, 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 i.e. Muhammad is not the central figure of Islam. He plays an important role, but he's not the center. Everybody on board? If anything obtains for Muhammad, what you may want to say is actually that Muhammad is the Martin Luther of Islam. It's to say, he is regarded in Islam as a reformer, just as Martin Luther reformed an original religious tradition from a Protestant perspective to get back to its original. So Muhammad also is reforming the religion of Abraham. We're going to learn this later, okay? So Muhammad is not to Islam that which Jesus is to Christianity. Everybody on board? Okay. Now, second proposition, good guy, bad guy. So what medieval constructions now do is they construct or portray Jesus as the hero, always the good stuff, and Muhammad always the bad guy. So attributes such as peace and war have their origins actually in early times, 8th, 9th century apologetic discourse are still with us in the 21st century. So for example, Jesus is claimed to be the Prince of Peace. He is always peaceful, right? And Muhammad is a warrior, right? I suggest that's a selective reading. Because if you look closely at Christian texts, Jesus ain't always the peaceful guy, right? So we have the story of the money changers. Anybody know the story? Want to tell us the story in three sentences?
They turn the table into like a marketplace, and he comes in and flips all the tables and gets money.
So they are doing wheeling and dealing in the temple, and he just comes in and throws over the tables, right? Causing quite a ruckus. Not particularly peaceful. It's also Jesus who says, I've come to bring not peace, but the sword. On the other hand, so this guy usually portrayed as peaceful, this one as a warrior. On the other hand, there's also lots of evidence that Muhammad is all, you know, Islamic tradition has peace inclinations, most prominently, assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, right? So it's a little more complicated. Both men have both sides, is what I would say for now. Okay. But it's a dichotomous construction that suits the theological service or desire of medieval Christians to portray Christianity as superior to Islam. Okay. Next one, Jesus said to have taught austerities and asceticism. That's kind of the medieval picture of Jesus versus Muhammad, who teaches pleasures and is indulgent. Again, out of context and actually in some cases totally out of thin air, the claims that, you know, they are opposite. Was Jesus always the aesthetic guy? You think about the marriage at Cana, where Jesus, in a sense, turns into, you know, the hero of every frat boy, right? He brings booze to the party. You all know the story of the wedding at Cana. They run out of, he's at a wedding, they run out of wine. Jesus asks for some water, a miracle, turns it into wine, right? So, no, he's not an ascetic guy. There are other scenes where the asceticism is not, definitely not there. On the side of Muhammad, accusations of medieval time, one of them, a woodcut from Germany, according to which Muhammad comes home drunk after, you know, long party at Khadija, his wife, is totally upset, and he curses the vine tree after that. Made out of thin air. There is not a single shred of evidence that, you know, anything like that ever happened. This is a medieval imagination run wild, and run wild to produce this dichotomy, to produce this opposite between Jesus and Muhammad. And we're going to see that over and over again. It's driven by this theological desire that Muhammad be the opposite of Jesus. You all following? Okay. So. And then add sex to the mix, and then you've got it full blown. So the basic proposition on both sides, Jesus as a celibate person, never married, versus Muhammad, who didn't just marry once, he married multiple times. And medieval thinkers had a blast with that, and not just medieval, but modern thinkers as well. So I have a couple of images here from Romanesque churches that were built in the context of the Crusades, at which point in time the tensions between Islamicate and Christendom civilizations were coming really to a head. And these are images of churches, some of them outside, some of them inside, that continue this accusation against Mohammedan Muslims that they are obsessed with sexual matters. Whereas we, Westerners, we Christians, of course, are the opposite. Right? We know how to use sex in a responsible fashion, if at all, whereas they are totally degenerate and are slaves to sexual passion. And we see this, and keep in mind, these are churches. These are Christian churches. So you have outside decorations that, according to Claudio Lange, a German photographer, represent Muslims in naked sexual poses. Right? All of them built in this context. So this is kind of the equivalent of Fox News. No, I'm sorry, I didn't say that. Of war propaganda of medieval times. Right? So here, for example, a Muslim woman who is exposing her genitalia upon entry of church, you see a Muslim woman exposing herself. How do we know she is a Muslim? The headscarf, right? Here we have a Muslim muezzin. A muezzin is somebody who calls prayer. You have to look closely. Of course, this is already weathered. But how do we see that this is a Muslim? He's wearing the turban and he's covering his ears. And the covering of the ears, a muezzin, when the person to prayer calls to prayer, you cover the ears and then you expel the call to prayer, right? So exposed, and that picture of the pedigree, a megaphallus exposed there, right? You're going to see here another Muslim, the beard, what do you call the top part of the beard?
Mustache.
Mustache, thank you. And then the traditional Arab greeting, right? So hand over the heart, that gives away that he's a Muslim. Now, some of you may be you know, somewhat suspicious. Are these really Muslims? Here we have megaphallus again. Here we have folks in very explicit sexual positions outside the church. And now we get inside the church. This one is in France. How do we know that this is a Muslim?
The prayer.
Prostration. And the most obnoxious one is this one. And this is actually in Switzerland. Right? How do we know that this is a Muslim?
Prayer.
And then what is he doing while praying? He's sexually so depraved that while praying he is sexually satisfying himself in an anatomic position that is very hard to, if possible, to... Whatever, let's leave it at that. From that sexualization of the enemy to modern times, many of you have seen Orientalist paintings. where Western, Victorian, European mindsets impose their own sexual fantasies on the Orient, right? And here we get into the rescue fantasies that Schuhart is talking about in the piece for today. So we have that mystical Orient, that holy other Orient that is very different from us. Our women dress properly and are not exposed. Exposures going on over there. Here's Henri with Turkish baths. From Orientalist art, moves over into opera, and Führung aus dem Serail. There are several Orientalist operas that pick up this theme, including rescue fantasies in there, right? Poor woman who is captured by the Sultan and is locked up in the harem, and we white male Westerners have to come to rescue her from those sexually depraved Orientals. Right? So that theme of the sexually depraved Oriental is continued in art, in high art. Right? High art. I'm also throwing in a little bit of kind of this visual exposure, among other things. Of course, this is of the African continent, no connection with Muslims, but this accusation, kind of turn of century, this up until the late 19th century, the colonialist desire to, in a sense, master and control and bring civilization to the uncivilized world. And uncivilized world means naked, exposed, not proper dressing, ultimately speaking, sexually depraved, other, that we as Western colonializers have to come in to and bring civilization to, and oftentimes bring religion as well. So this colonialist desire expresses itself then in constructing a third world, constructing the colonies as less, as other, as different from us. Do you see that? I want you to see that, because you can ask yourself the question, is that still going on in the 20th and 21st century? Who recognizes this picture? Okay. Where have you seen the picture? What's the context? Actually, it was before you watched time, right? Yes.
It was during one of the. It was in Afghanistan before. Right. I think in the early 90s.
Actually, the earlier 80s, right? About 85 or something like that. So, at the heights of the war. And she becomes the. Do you want to say something?
Oh, it was the same thing. Yeah.
And then they went back and found her.
And then they find go back and find her, right? So there is this very haunting image of what is a 12 to 13-year-old Afghan refugee that made the front cover of the National Geographic magazine in 84. This is, you know, and then they go back later in 2002 and find her and depict her again. And then the storyline behind that is, you know, aren't you so glad that we Americans came in and rescued you all? And, you know, helped you defeat the Taliban, and she is, no, I don't want anything to do with that. That's part of it, but the other part of it is the characterization, you know, she has suffered so much, she has aged so quickly. Well, she is not wearing mascara, and she is not wearing makeup, but you cannot really say that this is, you know, somewhat a very unnatural way of aging, right? So there's this introduction, even today, this introduction into, you know, third world women or they don't have access to L'Oreal, right? That kind of idea is in there. So I want you to think a little bit about that as well. And then Orientalism, and now to Schuhart, right? That type of Orientalism, that and pre-Orientalism, I would say, that the medieval Christian theological apologetic desire has to construct Islam as the opposite of Christianity, is that desire still with us in the 21st century? If so, first of all, the question, are we impacted by this long history of othering, by this long history of Orientalism? And then, in how far is that still being reproduced in the 20th and the 21st century? So here, you know, one of the early ones that Schuhart mentions, right? The Sheikh, you know, male coming in and rescuing poor woman from the sexual aggression of those Orientals, right? We have to get her out of there and bring her back to civilization, and in the process actually, you know, sexually make her available for ourselves, right? So there's a number of conflicting ideas going on. Elvis, your parents or grandparents' generation, right? We're continuing that theme to a certain extent, particularly the harem theme that is still with us today. And these are just the milder versions that I can put in a PowerPoint in a Furman classroom. The harem theme is so pronounced, of course, clearly expressive of, you know, Western sexual imagination of the other. But then yours generation, this is what you all, this is your diet, right? This is what you grew up on. How much of that Orientalism and that sexualization of the Orient is still with us today? How much of that did you all yourselves grow up with? Who wants to take one or two shots at a Latin? One, two, which names? Midriff, right, and not a whole lot of cavalry, right?
Elena. And, okay, they kind of depict, like, Jafar as creepy Amanda, who was the evil character and everything, but, like, I remember this one scene where she gets, like, she, like, had to, like, date Jafar because he became, like, the head of it all or something.
Right.
And then when she fell, like, for Aladdin or something and tried to trick him, he, like, put her in, like, I don't know, those things, like,
Is she putting him, finally, I forget, is she putting him back into the lamp? Is that what it is, or?
It's like one of those.
Oh, an hourglass. Okay. Okay.
It was, yeah.
So that mysteriousness in there.
Going off of that, like, he's this, like, really creepy man, and then she's, like, super young, and he's, like, fascinated by her, and, like, wants to.
So the old geezer, right? And look at the nose of the old geezer here, right? First of all, the accent that he has. What's the accent of these various main actors? One, two, three, four. How would you characterize the accent? Where are these folks coming from?
Foreign. And what? I would say that, the creepy character actually sounds like he's, I guess, from the movies. I haven't seen it since I was, like, five. But Aladdin and Jasmine and especially Genie, who's Robin Williams, it's all like American accents.
American, right.
So it's less, I guess, harsh to the children.
High school boy from Iowa, right? Not a New York accent, right? Somewhere in the nondescript Midwest, somewhere, right? And then, yes, of course, Robin Williams has, you know, his own slant on there. You just recognize my voice, right? So all of these, us, to a certain extent, and here's the other. And the other characterized also in skin tone and in physical characteristics. Big nose, where have we seen big noses before? Up until?
German propaganda
against?
Jews,
right? Anti-Semitic, right? Large hooked nose, that's how the Nazis portrayed Jews, right? That's the stuff that you were fed by Disney, family-friendly channel, right? 15, 20 years ago. Right? And you still fed some of that. Skin tone, darker skin tone versus lighter skin tone in there. Here's your prototypical American high school boy, funny and all, right? And here is the Arab, the evil, wicked geezer who is after our women, right? So that same innuendo of sexuality is in there. And then as far as clothes is concerned, yeah, this is how we imagine Oriental women that need rescuing. So you were fed that at the same time that you probably were living on a dress code in your own school, right? What you can and cannot wear. How many of your own middle school's dress code is our princess violating. How far would she make it into the hallway before she would be tackled by the principal?
Would not make
them
into
the high
school.
Not into the high school, right? So that's kind of the messages that you're getting, right? Those women overexposed. And of course, that is interesting, particularly when you liken that to the other accusation. This is now former president's wife, Laura Bush, who in the context of the initial war on terror in Afghanistan, she actually gets what appears to be the first, and that's funny in itself to a certain extent, the first radio address, not by male president, but by president's wife, right? And in that context, she is making a few observations about our military progress in Afghanistan, and she's not explicitly saying that, but it's kind of implied in there. We are engaging in war in Afghanistan to liberate those poor women who, among other things, are overdressed now. Right? So there is this troubles of underdressedness that we saw in Orientalist discourse, but there is also the troubles of overdressedness in the criticism of the veil, right? How many of you are aware of various veil controversies in various parts of the world? What are some of the controversies? 1, 2, 3, 4, if you want to share some of those.
French ban.
So that's about 2 sentences on that.
So the hijab, like the women weren't allowed to wear it, and there's much controversy over how they're able to express themselves.
So the question, yeah, can you publicly wear the hijab, and face veil in particular in France right now, banned, you actually get a ticket for that, right? So here are now Oriental women that are overdressed. So overdressed, underdressed, what is it? What has changed? You know, how much does it say about, quote-unquote, the Middle East, the Orientals, and how much do those controversies actually say not about them, but about us? And our own normativities, our own understanding of gender, our own desires. Right? So those questions. Was it hand raised or?
Yeah. Well, just in regards to that, the American ignorance that we know what's right for the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. We're going to impose that upon them, no matter what.
Of course we know. Who else would if not us? That's so, you know, that's part of understanding of pushing. But I would say, to a certain extent, back to medieval times, those dichotomous constructions, right, that we have from early onward, Muhammad versus Jesus, right, those religious roots of the constructions still play a role in more subtle forms today. Simon, you have
here. I was going to use the French example, but also you can flip it when you see it in countries like Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. that all women must have some sort of head cover, and that would be controversial, especially if you're a Christian woman visiting that country.
So in some cases, right, problem with both, right? In one case, you cannot wear, and somebody else, it is actually the hegemonic authority of the country that is telling you what to do. In one case, this, you cannot wear it, and in the other case, you must wear it. So that's true for Saudi Arabia, that's true for Iran, and that's true for Afghanistan and the Taliban, right? So there may be problems with both. And then you can ask yourself the question of, you know, various powers that are in play to create those, and what are the desires? What's the question, the issue of autonomy of women, etc., etc. Back to the dichotomy. So on celibacy versus polygamy, a lot of questions of sexuality pinned on that single question. And then, of course, Jesus as part of a true trinity, ergo Muhammad must be part of a false trinity. And this is one of the examples where you clearly see that this dichotomy is produced purely by theological desires. Because when you look at it, the medieval accusation is that Muslims worship Muhammad together with Apollo, Greek god, and Termagant, some deity that nobody has ever heard of. It's absolutely ludicrous. There is nothing in Muslim sources, ancient or modern, that would suggest anything like that. Muhammad is not object of veneration in Islam at all. He's not a god. Right? So this shows you very clearly that this dichotomy is produced by nothing but the theological desire of Christian apologetic discourse. We need an other. We need our binary opposite so as to denigrate the religious tradition. You are following the argument? Then, and on to that, Jesus the wise man, Muhammad the illiterate. Now here, incidentally, medieval discourse is picking up on a topos that is actually developed by early Muslim discourse. Muslims actually claim that Muhammad was illiterate. It's a theological claim that has to do with the claim that the Quran is a miraculous book. Muhammad could not read, hence getting to the Quran, we're going to talk about this, getting to the Quran is all the more miraculous. Right? So that's what explains the illiteracy of Muhammad. But Christian apologetic discourse turns it around. Smart guy versus not so smart. Right? So another one that explains itself. So Blaise Pascal has this one to say, Jesus is alive and in heaven, and Muhammad is dead and buried in Medina. Right? So again, this kind of dichotomy, of course, based on theological claims, to further this dichotomy. And then that hell theme is in there as well. Lastly, if Jesus is the Christ, who must Muhammad be? Of course he must be the opposite, so he's the Antichrist. Right? And that is actually what Melanchthon, contemporary to Martin Luther, has to say, right? Er ist der Antichrist. Martin Luther, at this point in time, early 16th century, actually says, no, he's not. Er macht's zu grob, right? So Martin Luther, at this point in time, his biggest headache is the Pope in Rome. So for Martin Luther, the Pope in Rome is the Antichrist. But Muhammad, when he talks about, he's not even refined enough to be the Antichrist, according to Martin Luther. Now, this is the important takeaway. When we talk about Jesus and when we talk about Muhammad, we are not just talking about individuals. Ultimately speaking, the assertions that we make about them are assertions about ourselves. Right? When I attribute something to Jesus, what I really mean to say is, that's me, that's my idea. Right? And when I talk about Muhammad, when medieval Christians talk about Muhammad, that's them, that's the other. That's not just Muhammad, but that's Muslims. Right? And so this is what we have then. Out of these assertions, what we find is accusations against Muslims that are still with us today. Right? We Christians are the peace-loving folk. It's them terrorists that are the violent ones. Right? We have our sexualities under control. It is them that are sensual, lustful, that are out of control when it comes to sexuality. We... actually, this one doesn't match, but the backwardness, the illiteracy of Muhammad, I don't know why that got switched, but that one is supposed to be going here. We are the educated one, they are the backward ones, right? Now, remember that these notions were generated at a point in time, crusades, and some of them actually before, some of them going back to the 8th and 9th century, at a point in time when, particularly when it comes to this one, that's kind of hard to believe, that the early medieval Europeans would accuse Muslims of being the stupid ones, right? And of course it totally undermines, or it totally puts undercover the indebtedness that Christian Europe has to the Islamic world. Simple example is this one here. Let's see. Somebody add that for me. I'm not even sure myself. See, are they actually in the right order? L is 50, right? C is 100. Do I have that correct? Should I switch them? Somebody add that one for me. Which of these two is oriental? Arabic universe, right? What is this?
Roman.
Roman, Occidental, right? That's us. That's them Christians, right? Okay. So, that stuff. And when it comes to science in medieval times, we are deeply indebted to Islamic civilization. How, for example, do you do this one in Roman numerals? You can't. It doesn't exist. Zero is a marvelous invention and realization that we get from the Muslims who got it from the Hindus. Where would we be without zero today? Forget about cell phones, forget about clocks, forget about anything, right? We'd be drumming on the tree still. So there is huge indebtedness to the Islamic world from medieval times that is totally eradicated and forgotten in this one, right? That is totally covered up. And so you may ask, you know, from a psychological perspective, why is it that we have this need to put them down that much, particularly given that we are so indebted to them, what is going on there? That's a question for a psychologist. But again, back to that basic dichotomy, whatever we say here, ultimately speaking, we are saying about Muslims at large. Okay, let's leave it at that. We have 2 or 3 minutes for observations, questions.
Because the Arabic people picked up zero from the Hindu numbers, is that why they adopted the Hindu system instead of their own Arabic numbers?
I think there is some overlap on that. I'm not exactly sure, you know, how the Arabic numerals as, you know, because these are not Arabic in the sense that you know Arabic, right? So what further development is there, I am not absolutely sure about. Yeah. What I am sure about is to think about zero, that actually takes some good stuff, right? You actually have to think about nothing. And that is actually, it's a complicated concept, right? So, thank goodness to the Muslims giving us a little of the bounty that they got from the minions, right? Because otherwise, where would we be? Okay. On Thursday, I think we're going to jump into... Just quickly.
It's a resistance on the...
Bring that up. Ahmed 1 and 2.
Is that chapter 1 and 2?
Yep. That's what it is. Let's just quickly bring this up here. Because we still have a minute or so, in spite of all of the zippers going already. So we're going to be starting to talk about the life of Muhammad and women. So yeah, read chapters 1 and 2 of the Ahmed book. And then somewhere in there, I think it's the 22nd already, email me somewhat of a topic so we know what we're talking about. At this point in time, how many of us have somewhat of an idea of the topic that we want to do? How many of us are still struggling? Struggle hard, and hopefully it will have something. See you all on Thursday.